This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guests are two Wall Street Journal reporters who broke significant parts of the Enron story. John Emshwiler and Rebecca Smith have written a book that chronicles the collapse of Enron and describes their experiences investigating the story. The book is called 24 Days. That's a reference to the time between October 16, 2001, when Enron released its third quarter report, which showed a $618 million loss, and November 8th, when Enron filed its own report with the SEC, laying out an array of misdeeds, hidden deals, and bogus accounting. Emshwiler and Smith were ahead of the story. They'd started investigating Enron in mid-August after the surprise resignation of Enron's CEO, Jeff Skilling. The reporters uncovered shady partnerships that helped explain Enron's massive losses. They published the first of their investigative articles October 17th, the day after Enron's disastrous earnings report was released. You started working on the Enron story after the sudden resignation of the CEO, Jeff Skilling. Why wasn't his resignation just business as usual? CEO resigns, big deal, another CEO resigning.
Well, it wasn't business as usual, Terry, because Jeff Skilling was not your average CEO. We're talking about a man who was at the head of a company that had been an absolute juggernaut in corporate America, and he had worked his way to the top, some might say clawed his way to the top over a 10-year period, and yet here suddenly in August of 2001, he suddenly and inexplicably quits, citing personal reasons. No one knew of any personal reasons, so that raised questions immediately.
Well, you called the publicist for Enron, who kind of said, yeah, personal reasons, and then you got an interview with Skilling himself. What did he tell you that raised more doubts in your mind?
Yeah, well, I did the interview the day after he quit, and it was the strangest interview I've ever done, probably as a reporter with a senior executive of a major company. And it was as much as what he said, it was sort of how he said it. He sounded like a depressed man who was given to long, sort of rambling sentences, almost speaking to himself. I was barely asking any questions. And instead of talking about personal reasons, which he sort of started with, he starts talking, as again, almost to himself, about the stock price of Enron's stock, which had been falling, like much of the stock market, for the past 12 months or so. And, you know, he kept telling himself, well, if the stock price only stayed up, it would be okay. And then at one point he said, you know, I'd still be there. It'd be all right. And I sort of stopped him and said, excuse me, Mr. Skilling, are you saying that if the stock price hadn't fallen, you wouldn't have resigned? And there was this kind of pause, and he said, and really almost like a little boy's voice, he said, yeah, I guess so. And we're thinking, well, guy, we got a story here. But nothing else, the man's contradicted the official line from the day before. So, as I say, it was a very strange interview that raised some questions about, at least about what was going on with Skilling, and maybe something then, you know, the question would be going on at Enron. And that same day, we made a second discovery that sort of also whetted our interest about the company and what was going on inside.
What was that discovery?
Well, that was when, as I was sort of preparing for the interview with Skilling, what we often do at the Journal is you go back and read, like, some recent filing the company made with the Securities and Exchange Commission, which all big companies, public companies, have to periodically file with the SEC about their financial results and what's been going on at the company. And as I read their most recent filing, I came across a section that's always there called Related Party Transactions, which usually is about deals that company executives or directors have with the company itself, sort of the dirty laundry list sometimes about, you know, if a director has a consulting contract or the nephew of the chairman has a vice presidential post. They got to put that in Related Party Transactions. And the ones for Enron, I'd never seen anything like it before. And I'd been reading these things for a fairly long time as a journal reporter. And they're talking about these unnamed partnerships run by some unnamed senior executive officer that seemed to be doing hundreds of millions of dollars of business with Enron. You couldn't quite tell from the gobbledygook they put out in this footnote what exactly the deals, what impact they're having on Enron, but it seemed obviously very suspicious. Here you had some senior official, you had big amounts of business, and these partnerships. So the first thing I did that day was to call the head of PR for Enron, because my first assumption was, well, maybe that's Jeff Skilling they're talking about. Maybe that's why he resigned.
But you found out that it wasn't Jeff Skilling who was running these partnerships. It was actually Andy Fastow, who is the chief financial officer of Enron. What were the clues that you found that revealed that it was Fastow?
Well, the funny thing, of course, is that he was unnamed in that report, but if you went back to earlier footnotes and earlier reports, Every so often, under the law, they had to name the related party. And once a year at Enron, they did. They also, when you called them, the Enron said, oh, that was Andy Fastow, because, you know, I was thinking it's Jeff Skilling, and they wanted to, you know, disabuse me of that notion. And so we find out it's Fastow. They say, oh, these are perfectly legitimate. They've been going on for 2 years. Nothing to worry about. But we thought there was something to worry about. We thought they were at least strange and that they were at least worth mentioning in the paper, which we subsequently did make a mention of these partnerships in the paper. And then that led to a phone call that Rebecca got.
Rebecca, before we talk about the phone call, why were you so concerned about the partnership? Why was the idea that the CFO was running these partnerships a conflict of interest in your mind?
Well, because Andy Fastow, as the CFO, had a sworn fiduciary duty to put the interests of investors ahead of his own interests. And yet here he was running partnerships that were conducting vast sums of business with a company, and it appeared to John and I that he was making millions of dollars off of this relationship. And in fact, you know, this is the sort of thing that you would have expected the Enron board to have said, no way, you cannot do that. That's a violation of your fiduciary duty.
So these partnerships were separate businesses that he was profiting from that might not have been in the best interests of the stockholders?
Yeah, what we knew at the beginning was, as Becky's mentioned, is that, you know, you had these separate entities, and Andy Fastow was running them, and according to the SEC filings, had a part ownership interest in them, and they were doing lots of business with Enron, where he was the CFO. So, you know, if you have a business transaction between two sides, you know, the two sides are always trying to get the most they can for their side. The problem is you had Andy Fastow on one side as the head of the partnership, and Andy Fastow on the other side as the CFO of Enron, and he couldn't get the best deal for both of them. Somebody's interest had to get lost in that. You know, somebody might come out better in the negotiations because you had Andy on both sides. So he had a situation where, like, it was just a built-in conflict.
Except that early on, in the period you're talking about here, Terry, we didn't actually know what was being done with these partnerships exactly. All we knew was that there was something going on that looked nefarious and looked like a violation of what are considered just basic bedrock conflict of interest rules.
Well, Rebecca, let's get back to that call that you got that gave you more clues.
Right. Well, we put what we knew in a story that ran in the journal, which is called Heard on the Street. And we really didn't know very much about these partnerships. We actually quoted from one of the Securities and Exchange Commission filings to show how convoluted and arcane and gobbledygookish was Enron's explanation. And we were hoping that it might shake loose some additional information, which it did, because right after that column ran, I received a phone call from someone saying, hey, the story was good, but basically you don't know the half of it. Call me if you would like to learn a little bit more. And I did, and had several conversations with that person, who turned out to be a treasure trove of information, because this person had internal documents that really mapped out for us what it was that Andy Fastow was doing with these partnerships and how he was putting his own interests and the interests of his separate investors ahead of that of Enron.
And the irony, in a way, is that, you know, we were, if it hadn't been for that call, Rebecca and I made this one story and put out this mention of these partnerships, thinking at the very least it was worth putting on the record in the newspaper like the Journal. But I think both of us were planning, if we didn't get much reaction, we'd just go on and go on to other stories, because we didn't have any other place to go with the information that we had about the partnerships. And Fastow had resigned from the partnerships 2 weeks earlier, for unexplained reasons. But so this call was really critical, because otherwise, you know, we might have just let the story go and moved on and dropped it.
What did these partnerships do? What kind of businesses were they?
Well, basically, there were two partnerships, both of them called LJM. They came to be known LJM1, LJM2. And as we learned later, the LJM were the initials of Fastow's wife and two sons. And basically what they were done is they were set up to protect Enron from having to report losses in its various investments that were going sour. And so what Andy Fastow would do is he'd go out and get outside investors. He'd get usually big institutions that did business with Enron and therefore had some reason to want to keep Enron happy.
Oftentimes banks.
Banks. And or investment banks that did business with Enron, they'd put in money in the LJM2 partnership. They put in close to $400 million. And that money would then be used to help set up various transactions with Enron. They'd set up like a third entity. So Enron would be there, LJM2. They'd set up another entity, and they'd stuff basically Enron stock into the entity, and then they'd stuff Enron's bad investments into the entity, and basically use the value of the stock to hide the losses in the other investments through some complex accounting transactions. But you needed that outside party like LJM2 to make the accountant satisfy that this really could be taken off of Enron's books.
Well, let me quote the kind of report that you had to read in order to figure out what the heck was happening. Here's one of the Enron reports, and you quote from this in your book. It's an earnings report that referred to $544 million in, quote, related losses associated with certain investments, principally Enron's interest in the new power company, broadband technology investments, and early termination during the third quarter of certain structured finance arrangements with a previously disclosed entity. What? Certain structured finance arrangements with a previously disclosed entity. I mean, what does that mean?
You see, this is why you're in a black box, and that's what these so-called disclosures showed. There's no way reading that to know what on earth they're talking about. We didn't know. The equities analysts didn't know. And this is why it really required documents from the inside to explain what are these transactions and what are these entities, because it was very complicated.
Yeah, essentially what those entities were, we learned, they were talking there about four entities that all went under the name the Raptors. And those entities were essentially used to help produce on paper for Enron over $1 billion of pre-tax income in like a two-year period, roughly nearly half of all the reported income they had for that period. And you wouldn't know that until you got deep into Enron what was going on. So they just had these kind of like meaningless code words that they could say their lawyers would tell them, okay, that satisfies your disclosure requirement. You said something, even though it doesn't mean anything to the average investor or even the very sophisticated investor on the outside. But that's sort of what Enron had evolved into, that it was sort of trying to meet the letter of the law as interpreted by themselves, their lawyers and their accountants, without ever giving any sense of what was really happening at the company.
At some point during your investigation, you decided you needed to speak to the people at the top of Enron. So you talked to Enron's PR guy, and he told you that he wanted your questions written in advance, and then he would submit the questions, and they would decide what to do. And you complied. You wrote 21, you know, pretty tough questions. Why did you comply with that? You could have said, sorry, we don't do that. We don't give questions in advance. We want the interview. Well, we're not going to tell you what the questions are.
This is something actually John and I debated some, because we had a difference of opinion. I felt that in the questions we submitted, we tipped our hand too much. I felt we showed too much of what we had. But an argument could be made, and it was a strong one that John made, that they're going to know everything we have in the end anyway. We might as well tell it to them now, let them respond now. My fear was that this would then, they would be less inclined to respond because they would be sort of frightened of the amount of information that appeared that had come to us.
And that seems to be what happened. They didn't give you the interview.
Well, yeah, they didn't give us the interview. And I still don't think it was a mistake, because I think, you know, as Becky said, we're going to have to give them the questions anyway. It has become a much more common tactic in corporate America to ask for questions in advance. I've never felt constrained to, you know, one, to give them all my questions, or to, you know, you just the questions you get. I also found that, you know, in some ways their silence was more eloquent than if they had given us interviews, because Enron had this reputation for being very confident, almost to the point of being cocky, in dealing with the press, that they were always available, that they were always, you know, because they thought they had such a great story and a great ability to tell the story, that they were happy to bring in reporters and just overwhelm them with information and certitude. When they actually came back and refused to talk to us, that in as much perhaps as anything, told me that there was something much bigger inside of Enron about these partnerships.
Would you have handled this episode differently in retrospect? You know, if you could do it over again, would you have submitted those questions in advance?
Yeah, I don't actually think it made much difference. I don't think Enron, as I look back on it, was going to talk.
Well, I think that we made a tactical error in submitting such detailed questions. Would it have made a difference in the end? Probably not. But I do think that we might have elicited a little more information on the LJM partnerships early on. But again, in the long run, I don't think it would have mattered.
Are there any Enron executives that have yet faced any punishment?
No one has. I mean, several people have been charged with crimes. A couple have pleaded guilty. No one has actually had to stand trial yet.
But that's not so unusual, really, because, you know, big, complex, especially white-collar crime investigations can take years. I think it was 3 years plus before the Justice Department, Rudy Giuliani, and the SEC brought their case and closed it out against Mike Milken back in the 80s and the great insider trading scandals of Wall Street. And in some ways, Enron is far more complex than what, Drexel and the other big firms were doing back in the 80s. So, I mean, it's going to take them a while.
I know some skeptics think that the reason why it's taking a long time is because Kenneth Lay has close connections with President Bush, and because all the execs at Enron were so wealthy that maybe they could buy a more favorable form of justice for themselves.
Well, they can certainly hire expensive lawyers, and to the degree that helps them, manipulate the process. I guess that's the same is true for all rich people. I actually think that at this point, Ken Lay's connection to the Bushes works against him, because he's now in the worst of all positions in a way. George Bush can no longer take campaign donations from Ken Lay, so in that sense, Ken Lay's useless to George Bush, the politician. And at the same time, I don't think Bush wants to have to take the heat for saying, oh yeah, we couldn't find a case against my old friend Ken Lay. If anything, I would suspect, the Justice Department folks, if they were told anything by the White House, would be to, well, if you've turned over all the rocks on Ken Lay, turn them over again to make sure before we have to make the admission we're not going to bring a case against Ken.
But I think the main thing that's helping Ken Lay and Jeff Skilling and others right now is the sheer complexity of the financial structure that was developed, because a prosecutor knows that if they bring a case, they've got to be able to explain it to a jury. And, they went after Arthur Anderson for obstruction of justice and very nearly lost that case. And it was, in comparison, child's play. It was such a simple case in comparison with what we're talking about with these other transactions.
And in retrospect, one of the more astonishing things about the Enron saga might turn out to be how little of it was illegal. Because, one of the things the prosecutors are running up against in Enron is that so many of these transactions, these off-balance sheet deals that look so scummy, had been approved by Arthur Anderson, the outside auditor, and the attorneys that looked over them. And that's a very potent defense in a criminal case. If an executive can say, well, my outside experts told me it was okay to do, it's very hard for a prosecutor to get over that.
What are the legal charges against the Enron executives now?
Well, there's a variety of charges, mostly related to fraud, conspiracy, money laundering, obstruction of justice.
Wire fraud.
Yeah, so they've used these various, sort of categories of crimes to then, discuss the specific acts of individuals. Andy Fastow so far has the largest array of charges against him. I think his superseding indictment now includes 109 counts. Now, some of those are, repeat crimes. They repeat different counts of the same kind of crime, say money laundering. But basically those kinds of things. So it runs a fairly wide gamut.
There are some who've been accused of wrongful acts in connection with these partnerships, and others with wrongful acts related to the California energy crisis and trading type infractions.
So, and then there's a kind of the partnerships, the trading, and then there's a sort of a third group now emerging where they've related to Enron's broadband operation, where they're basically charging senior executives of that unit with having lied to the public about the financial condition and business prospects of that unit while making large amounts of money selling Enron stock, of their own stock. So you've got these three different areas that are kind of mining the federal government, and there may well be others as they start looking at other senior executives, as well as, of course, the two most senior executives still out there would be Lay and Skilling.
How would you say Enron relates, if at all, to the movement to recall Governor Gray Davis in California?
I think that, you know, one of the things that Gray Davis is accused of was flubbing the energy crisis. And there's no question but what earlier intervention by his administration might have made the crisis less severe. But he did what government officials and bureaucrats often do with something unfamiliar. They decide they're going to study it and study it, and he studied it to death. Meanwhile, it was spinning out of control. So from that standpoint, I think there is some culpability. But in a larger sense, what we now know is that there was a flawed market structure in California that was exacerbated tremendously by entities like Enron and other traders that were trying to exploit every opening that they could find. And certainly Gray Davis is not responsible for the fact that they didn't care how much money they were able to suck out of the system. They were going to go for it. And they didn't care if in the end it ruined a market.
A lot of people, a lot of readers of the Wall Street Journal feel like the investigative staff of the paper reveals things in its investigations that contradict the position of the editorial page.
We hope so.
So I'm wondering where you think Enron fits into that. I mean, you helped uncover this incredibly corrupt, really large organization that, you know, shareholders lost money. People who worked for Enron lost money. It reveals the really ugly side of capitalism. Capitalism has gone really astray. So what's the difference, do you think, between what you saw in your investigation and what the editorial pages ended up saying or what they had said before?
Well, I think the editorial pages, you know, they're obviously great champions of American capitalism and great, you know, disparagers of government regulation of American capitalism. But to give them their due, I think they were fairly hard when Enron came down. They were especially hard, for instance, on the banks, who they thought were these kind of corrupt enablers, as I read some of our editorials. Because they think, you know, their feeling would be at least stated is that, well, you know, when capitalism is a great thing, but when bad things happen, the market has to correct it. The market has to, you know, wreak its, you know, sort of justice on the wrongdoers. And so I would assume they think, you know, Enron should be punished, but it doesn't say something more fundamental about the system of the marketplace. Whereas other people look at it and might say, well, yeah, it says something about the marketplace and why we need to regulate the marketplace in certain ways in order to restrain the, you know, sort of the more cowboy parts of capitalism.
But one of the tenets, of course, of market capitalists from Adam Smith and the Wealth of Nations on down, of course, is that in order for a market to operate, it has to have information. And, of course, Enron is the anti-information. Enron, the information it puts out is incorrect. It's misleading. So there was no defense on the part of the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal for duplicity and corruption and financial chicanery, because markets cannot operate, they cannot self-correct unless they know what it is that's going on.
What's left of Enron? It still exists?
It's still very much a functioning company. I mean, it's been in bankruptcy for more than a year now, but it still owns utilities, pipelines, power plants, many, many hard assets, although it's no longer in the energy trading business. It still has a book of contracts from that business. So there's a lot of it still there trying to refashion itself into something that will survive, but it with a new name.
Yeah, the funny thing about Enron may be in that, you know, after the whole era of Skilling and the creation of the new, the modern Enron, what emerges from bankruptcy is the eventual company may look very much more like the little kind of old state natural gas pipeline company that the company was back in the early 1980s before the great transformation began. So it's almost like back to the future. Or future to the back,
or ashes to ashes, dust
to dust.
Yeah,
right. But I mean, it's you know, after, you know, after tooling up this company that was going to be the one of the great paradigms for 21st century business, it may just get back to being a, you know, kind of a staid old natural gas pipeline company.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you. It was great.
John Emshwiler and Rebecca Smith are the authors of the new book, 24 Days. They write for the Wall Street Journal.